You can't start the car. Johnny has the keys.
Hello, hello, hello out there in podcast and YouTube land. You have reached Johnny Has the Keys, where we talk about horror movies and science fiction films and those key elements that lift them above the average genre fare. If you have not joined us before and are joining us for the first time, welcome. Mm-hmm. We would like to assimilate you into our Borg apparatus of nonsense and ingenuity and nerdy bullshit. If you're a returning person, well, welcome back, because obviously you get us and the nonsense that I am speaking of. I am here with my good friend David Horton. He's my podcast partner and partner in crime as far as this podcast goes.
Yep.
How goes it, David?
It goes really well. I like that intro. I love the science fiction references. That was good.
You did good. Oh, that's right. I guess I did.
You even mentioned something from Next Generation, which you didn't watch.
Which is so not look at you. My usual thing. No.
Not your usual. I'm good with that. It's been a weird week. I did something really weird this week, I want to tell you. It was because normally we do a genre, you know, what did you do genre? I did something totally non-genre, but I think you'll appreciate it.
Okay.
So, because of the Academy Awards and because of, you know, I love it anyway, I decided that I need to watch the new remake of West Side Story. So before
Is it available to stream?
Yes, but before I wanted to do that, I wanted to go back and watch the original again.
Oh, my God. I've seen that a billion times.
And it was so interesting because I suddenly got into it and started treating it like the podcast. So after I watched it, I went back and read reviews, and I looked at interviews, and I looked at stuff about Bernstein, and I looked at stuff about, I listened to other podcasters who had talked about West Side Story. And it was so interesting to do a science fiction or horror film analysis of something that was such a Broadway huge hit that was then turned into a movie that most people thought wouldn't be a hit and was a huge hit and is now generational and become this big remake. And I know you love it, right?
I do love it. And we've actually talked about a spinoff podcast where we do movies that aren't horror and science fiction because we have oodles of time and it would just be so easy to do.
Right, of course. Let's just do it.
I mean, I can think of, at least a good 40 movies right now that aren't horror or science fiction that would put on that list.
Definitely.
And West Side Story would be one of them. The original.
Oh.
For sure.
Oh, definitely. The Godfather would be one of them, that sort of thing for me. But it was just so interesting to see how topical it still is today. How this whole, we are basically, I don't know if it's genetic or whatever, we are a xenophobic species. And if you are different or you aren't like us, you're not in our clique, we don't want to be near you. And we want to go to war with you. And fight you and whatever else. And, it's based on Romeo and Juliet, which it was topical back then.
So it was topical in Elizabethan times.
Yes.
Right.
That's why I'm saying it's genetic. You know, maybe from the, from when we were in the caves as Cro-Magnon, we were like, no, if he's in the other cave, I don't like him. If he's wearing the deer antlers, no, I'm against him.
No. Or whatever. No, we only wear elephant tusk here.
We only wear the tusks here.
Yeah.
For the tusks. But the music, the incredible complexity of the music, that the choreography by Jerome Robbins, it was just so interesting to revisit and do the same approach we normally do with a movie with a genre movie to a mainstream film. And it was just a lot of fun.
It's one of those movies that just never dies. It's just that powerful of a movie. And we have talked, well, first of all, it's beautiful. The color's beautiful. The choreography's great. The story's great. We have joked about where Spielberg sometimes uses music to manipulate people when watching mm-hmm. a movie. Like, I'm going to make them cry here. Let's do something with the music. Mm-hmm. Well, there are elements in the original West Side Story that make me cry because of the music and the lyrics to the song. So now we're getting a version from Spielberg where we know he's already good at that. So yeah. How's he going to do it even more so?
I may just collapse as soon as the movie, you know, is over.
Right. Did you watch it?
No. Okay. I haven't seen the remake at all. I wanted to rewatch the original before I dive into the remake.
I saw the other day, before I go on to my weekly thing, that, you know, he's being acclaimed for this version. Mm-hmm. This version is supposedly really, really, really good. It is not your average remake. But he has taken some liberties with changing a few things. And I read the other day that he has actually got a scene where, Rita Moreno plays Doc's widow. Well, first mm-hmm. of all, I don't remember Doc dying in the movie.
No. They wanted a part for her, so they wrote her in as she's now the owner of the store.
Oh, okay. So there is no Doc. She's just the owner of the soda shop or whatever. Okay.
So she's the one that actually gets to look at all of them and say, what is wrong with you, kid?
Right.
You know, and that'll be good.
Well, that is good. But I also read that he wrote it to where she would be able to sing, I don't know if it's in the quintet or if it's just a solo, a version of Tonight. And they are saying that she may get nominated for an Academy Award. So she could essentially win an Academy Award for the same film twice.
That would be interesting.
I know. When I read that, I was like, holy cow, that is unbelievable. Because you know they'd probably give it to her. They better.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Anyway, I just thought I found that fascinating. On to my genre week. Well, yes. I was watching some really high class stuff. Mm-hmm. I'll have you know.
Just it like is stuff
we've
story.
Been discussing here lately. Mm-hmm. And I went and revisited Dracula.
Oh. Really?
Okay. I did. I went and watched Dan Curtis's 1974 version of Dracula with Jack Palance, Mr. Push-Ups himself.
Jack Palance. Yeah.
And I watched Blackula, which I don't think I had ever seen.
Really? I think I've only seen it once, back when it first came out, drive-in style.
With them big fake fangs and those blue, like, Romero zombie makeup.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I absolutely adored watching these movies. They're not great movies by any means. Mm-hmm. They're exactly what you would expect them to be. Dracula in particular, because, you know, God love him, I can watch anything Dan Curtis did back in the 70s, and he was not great, but he obviously cared about what he was doing and wanted to make it good. So he did what he could to make it good. And Richard Matheson wrote the screenplay to this particular version of it,
mm-hmm.
which is another, you know, a nice addition. He and Dan Curtis must have been friends because they did Trilogy of Terror together and The Night Stalker together, as well as
At that time, Curtis was probably the equivalent of a Flanagan of today
on television, you know,
multimedia sort of outlets to do his favorite horror. You know, I don't think Curtis is as good as Flanagan, but I think I've mentioned on the podcast several times, I still want to find, you know, the Norless tapes was a Dan Curtis show that I think should have been turned into a series and would have been so good.
I came across them in the list research the other day. I cannot remember if I put it on the list. I think I looked and it had a really low rating. And I thought, ooh, maybe not. But I cannot remember.
Mm-hmm.
But we could do it. I could add it.
I think it would be great. It's Roy Thinnes, I think, mm-hmm. plays the lead in it. And it really imprinted on me as a kid. You know, it's like we were talking.
Oh, no. It's the Deadly Mantis.
Yeah. It could be this movie's Quatermass. Great.
When I was a kid, I loved it.
It could be Quatermass in the Pit. That was good too, and I remember that as a kid.
That's so true.
You know.
That's true.
50-50.
Okay. Well, we will add that to the list. Just briefly with these two though, Nigel Davenport played Van Helsing in the
In the Dan Curtis, yeah.
Which is kind of cool. But Blackula had some cool casting as well because it had Star Trek alumni in it, including Charles McCauley, who was in Wolf in the Fold.
Mm, okay.
And Return of the Archons, I believe.
Yep.
And Elijah Cook. Our favorite Elijah Cook is in there. Yay. So yeah, it was fun. I almost watched Scream, Blackula Scream, because I think that's one of the best titles a movie has ever had, and I didn't.
I don't know. Mother Jugs and Speed is still one of mine that I go, they really made that movie, did they?
And also the original, or not the original, but the 1974 version of Dracula, his castle has lots of paneling in it. It looks more like a house.
It's Wayne Manor.
Yes, it's like very, I guess, you know, it's nice, but it's budgeted. They didn't have a budget for a castle, I guess. I don't know. Anyway.
Yeah.
So. And Charles McCauley plays Dracula in Blackula. He's the one that turns the African prince into a vampire, I guess you'd say, and dubs him Blackula. So
Blackula.
Yeah. Much 70s exploitation. So that's what I did.
But still, that whole thing of taking a classic and just it's lived through the decades. It continues to find a home, and we are obsessed. You know, you and I have talked about vampires. We talked about werewolves. We talked about zombies, of course, which are still popular. But I just think there's something about these iconic monsters that people keep recreating them and redoing them.
Right. Well,
even exploitation wise,
right? And there's the motifs behind them are ever present, very much like what we were talking about with West Side Story. You know, there's the romance motif, there's the sex motif, there's all this other underlying stuff that's, you know, evergreen as far as concept. So and that's one of the reasons.
You know, that's kind of a cool segue because we do have a kind of evergreen topic today in that we're talking about a movie that is about our first, quote, contact with alien life. And what would that be like? And we've done a few movies in the past on the podcast that have covered this science fiction trope. But, you know, this is one of those that got a lot of popularity. It got a lot of notice and everything when it first came out. And I'm really curious to dive into it with you and see what you think. We are talking about 1997's little pick with Jodie Foster called, ironically, Contact. Kind of blunt, to the point. There you go. It was written by James V. Hart, who we talked about just a couple of episodes, I think, back, because he did the adaptation of Bram Stoker's Dracula. He did the screenplay for this, based on the novel by Carl Sagan. It stars Jodie Foster, Matthew McConaughey, Tom Skerritt, several others. It was directed by Robert Zemeckis, who is coming off of a, you know, quite a big 80s decade of 90s, doing some incredible movies. A brief little synopsis of it, just so for those of you who haven't watched it, go watch it right now because we will spoil it. It's what we do. But the synopsis, to remind you that those of you who have seen it, is we're actually follow the story of Ellie Arroway, who is an astronomer. We meet her as a young child at the beginning, and she's fascinated with the CB radio and with radio transmissions and all that, and her dad encourages that, and that kind of leads to her becoming a scientist and then becoming an astronomer, and she's obsessed with extraterrestrial life. She gets involved with the SETI project, which is the search for intelligent extraterrestrial intelligence, and through the course of the movie, we follow her righteous obsession of science and of the fact that we're not alone. There's a famous line, which I know we'll talk to about when we talk about scenes and lines and everything else. But basically the movie, she goes to Arecibo in Mexico and is doing some research there.
I thought it was
there.
Puerto Rico.
In Puerto Rico, she goes first to Arecibo in Puerto Rico, until she is basically shut down by the head of the, president's task force on science, who's played by Tom Skerritt. It's a guy named Dave, the character's name is Drumlin. He basically pulls the plug on the project because his view of science is science should be applicable. It shouldn't be something that we just research and do and dream about.
It should be advantageous to human comfort
and something that has practical results. He's very results oriented, but they kind of go rogue and decide to go to New Mexico, and they're going to kind of rent telescope time, radio telescope time from the government, and there she actually does end up hearing a signal from a distant planet called Vega, and it's all about, essentially it's about how the political, the scientific and the religious extremes try to put together what would happen if we did get this message from an alien race and what do we do with it. Had you seen this movie before?
No.
You had not? Okay, interesting.
Never saw it.
And what did you think of it? I'm curious as your first.
I actually liked it. When I first started watching it, I had forgotten that it was a Robert Zemeckis film, and I was like, oh, this is very Spielberg-esque, as I'm watching it. Very big, very grand, large cast of famous people. And then you mentioned earlier that Zemeckis had come off of a lot of hits in the 80s. Well, the one that I associate him with most is Forrest Gump, which came out just a couple of years before this.
Yep.
And
mid-90s.
This movie had lots of elements of Forrest Gump that reminded me of Forrest Gump while I was watching it.
Well, it didn't help that Alan Silvestri did the music, and the same guy who did the music for Forrest Gump. And as a matter of fact, there were entire passages in this. I was going, did he just reuse the fucking music from Gump? Because A, it doesn't work where he put it, but B, it's the melody of it sounded just like a variation of Gump. I was going, did they just kind of repurpose that?
I don't know. But overall, I liked it. I mean, I know that there were some stretches as far as probably logic that I may even be unaware of just because I'm so ignorant to the subject. But I thought the cast was strong. I especially loved John Hurt's role when he finally Haddon? Came on. Yeah. Very Elon Musk type strangeness.
Yeah, they actually described it. Zemeckis described to John Hurt, he said, this would be what would happen if Bill Gates kind of went a little crazy.
Yeah.
So at that time in the mid-90s, that's what that was.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting, because I'm curious. It was your first time. It's my third time watching it, and I don't like this movie.
Oh, I'm shocked.
You know, I think it really falls apart really badly, especially like the last 15 minutes.
Well, I'm not saying it's a great movie. I was not bored. I thought I was going to be bored, and I was not bored.
Well, and it's amazing doing research on it, how many people this has inspired. So especially female scientific community, people said that Ellie was my role model. When I was 14 and 12, I saw Contact, and that's who I wanted to be. That's why I'm an astrophysicist. That's why I'm a molecular biologist. That's why I'm into science, was because she was a woman who stuck to her science, and she wanted it and wanted to dream it ever since she was a little girl, and da, da, da. So a lot of, the way, when we, in the other podcast, the way we talk about how many scientists were influenced by original Star Trek. When they were kids, they watched it, and that's what led them to become scientists.
Uh-huh.
This was kind of that kind of movie, I think, to a lot of young people at the time, which is great, and it should do that. And I really appreciate that. Mm-hmm. And especially being based on a novel by a guy who did so much for science when he was alive. And unfortunately, he never got to see this movie. Sagan died just 6 months before the movie came out. So he didn't get to ever see this film. I've never read the novel. So it's made me want to go back and read the novel now, because I've, in doing the research, seeing all the changes and differences that they made. And he was very much involved with the film. He was very much involved with the screenplay and working on it and making sure that there was scientific accuracy and that it wasn't just technobabble, that it actually made sense and stuff like that.
Apparently there was an ex-wife involved.
Yes. Yeah. And they basically
came up with the story with him.
Yeah. So production note wise, they actually, a few years before this, had gotten together. She had had the original idea. They ended up basing it on an actual radio astronomer who was a female. Let me see if I have her name in my notes.
I have it. It's Anne Druyan.
Yeah, Druyan. And so they actually based it on her. And they wanted it to be a teleplay, a movie. But then it went into development hell. And when it went into development hell, Sagan just said, okay, I'm just going to write the novel. So he wrote the novel of it and became hugely popular.
And she only gets credit for like the story.
Correct.
So they must have been split maybe by the time he came around to writing it, I guess.
Well, he didn't write the screenplay. It was still written by Hart.
No, I'm talking about the novel.
But yeah, the novel he wrote himself, yes.
So I'm assuming they were either not together anymore, or she didn't want to write it, or what? I don't know.
That would be my assumption. Yeah.
Okay.
Sort of thing. And then it was picked up, of course. Zemeckis really liked it. He assembled the cast for it, which we'll have to talk about when we do cast. What were there pluses and minuses that you had for it overall in a first watch sort of thing? Like you mentioned cast. Of course, cast is very strong in this.
I think, and this may be one of the minuses that you are not happy with, and I could be jumping to conclusions, but one of the minuses, I think, is when she finally gets there, she gets on the machine and goes to the other planet, it's almost a cop-out that they made the aliens resemble her father and all that. It's like they don't really, there's no payoff to the visit to another planet, really, at all.
That's exactly a huge minus. And that is, this, like I said, this is the third time I've seen it. The very first time I saw this movie, I went, what the hell happened to the ending? And I was just really pissed off. The second time I watched it, I could appreciate some of what Zemeckis was trying to do and the through line and everything else. And I really liked the Haddon character a lot more. Sort of thing, but still didn't like the ending and thought, you know, oh, it's okay, science fiction, but it doesn't pay off at the end. Mm-hmm. And then this time I got just really pissed off because
it's so funny. I thought we were going to have a totally different conversation about this movie. So this is hilarious to me.
These aliens send this thing all the way out to the cosmos for whatever advanced races might be able to understand it and construct it and have somebody get in it just to come back and say, we're just showing you this because this is all you can understand and I'm your dad and da 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 and this is the first step and goodbye, go back. No proof, no nothing, just go back.
Oh yeah, they're probably going to think you really just dreamed all this.
Yeah, so good luck with that the rest of your life sort of thing. And maybe one day we'll see you again because this is the way, even the line, this is the way it's been done for millions of years. Oh, yeah, really? So that pissed me off. There's no payoff for the aliens and no real reason for them to do what they did. Mm. Right. But then they have the whole Senate hearing thing, which is just like a total slap in the face. And suddenly Ellie changes her entire character in the last scene. And it's like, seriously? You even stood up your chance to take the trip in the first place. You defied the Senate and looked right at him and said, no, I'm an atheist and that's what I believe and that's the way it is. And at this end, this guy comes up with this stupid idea about, oh, it's a hoax from H.R. Haddon. Oh, really? The alien technology design and everything was a hoax? Seriously? And you go, yeah, well, I guess I have no proof. I'm sorry. Right? What's the first rule of science? Repeat the experiment. Try it again. Put somebody else in it. I don't care. We'll just do it again and see what happens now.
Well, there's a couple other minuses now that I think about it. One was that they had built another one in secret at the exact same time. I'm like, well, you're not going to televise this one?
Well, it's because Haddon had done that one with the Japanese.
I know, but all of a sudden, people that were involved in the first one were there.
Well, yeah, because he wants to power it up. He has to have those people help. Yeah, I thought that
was
weird,
too. And,
like,
all of a sudden, Ellie's the lead contender to go. And I'm like, oh, okay.
Well, that's because he owns it. He owns that one. You know. Yeah. But, yeah, in the novel, from what I've read, in the novel, there's a lot more. Like, in the novel, 8 people go. It's not a single ship.
So they could all corroborate their stories.
Correct.
Yeah.
And the ending of the novel, from what I've been, what I've read about, said, you know, is much more of defiant of, no, this happened. We are scientists telling you to believe in faith. Mm-hmm. They're kind of wrapping that stuff. Yes, believe in us with no proof because it really happened to all 8 of us and we're going to go back. And so there's a lot more of the overlapping of religion and science and stuff in a much more realistic way than, well, there's 18 hours of static that we're just not going to tell anybody about, you know.
Yeah. I have another minus if you want to hear it.
Please. I love minuses.
Jake Busey was horribly miscast.
Oh, my gosh.
This movie.
It's like, excuse me, red flag from the very beginning.
Hey, bad guy, look over here.
Yeah. And hey, bad
guy. You don't have any lines, but you're the bad guy.
You're the white albino who's staring. Every time you stare, I know you're the bad
guy. Yeah, I actually have a picture of him. There he is.
Yeah. Yeah, no. And that wig, again, I mean, this is like bad Harry Potter. You know, yeah. This just doesn't work.
But I don't know. Not only was he obviously going to be a big monkey wrench and a bad guy in this, it's so set up once you realize that she's not the one chosen that something's going to go wrong. And you just know, all of a sudden you're sitting there writing the screenplay in your head.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, what are they going to do or whatever? They're going to have a
well, that's explosion. The thing about this. This is just so disjointed. And I kind of, at first, I put it down to, oh, well, Sagan wrote the screenplay and he doesn't know how to write a screenplay because he's not a writer. He's a scientist who just happened to write a novel sort of thing. But no, Hart wrote the screenplay, but this screenplay is just plodding and weird. And the whole love interest thing with Joss doesn't work. It never pays off. It never goes anywhere. I don't understand it. Plus the fact that I'm not a big fan of McConaughey anyway. I've never thought he was really that good. You know, all right, all right, all right. You know, I mean, it's just never.
Thought he was okay. I bought that he was religious and that I really like the scene where he throws her under the bus. I thought, okay, that's pretty dramatic there. I'll give them that.
Yeah, I was struggling with, okay, so you write books about science and religion and that means you can just walk into private White House screenings.
That was weird. I was like, why are all these people here? Why do they don't belong here?
And Rob Lowe with his Christian cameo. I'm going, what was that all about? It's just moments in this movie that just don't work from a plotting perspective. Mm-hmm. You know, you're writing it. You're going, I don't know what you were trying to say there or do there.
Yeah, but I mean, we know what Busey's doing. We respect everybody's opinion at this meeting.
Right. Sure we do. Except the girl. Or except hers. When she
has
an opinion,
I'm going to kick your ass.
Now, I do like the way Skerritt played that kind of...
Oh, he was a great villain.
I will always take credit for your work kind of thing. And then look you right in the face and go, you know, sorry you can't go.
There was Skerritt was probably one of my favorite things about this, because you don't normally see him play a villain, and he does it really, really well and understated. And my favorite, one of my favorite lines, and I'm going to paraphrase it, is when he does confront her right before he's going to the launch, and she says, he says, you know, I didn't expect to see you here. And it's just one of those things, Ellie. It's the world we live in. Yeah. You know, we can't help it. And then she zings him with, like, the best line in the movie. She said, the world is what we make it. And yeah. I was like, drop the mic, man. That's the best line in the movie, because it basically summed up his character instantly.
Correct. He says something to the effect of, your problem is you always expect the world to be fair, and the world isn't fair. And the world is what we make it. Yeah. You know, I was going, okay. That, yes, I agree with you. That's a huge plus. The other scene I have as a plus is when she's actually doing the defense of her project, and Haddon is eavesdropping with the camera.
Yeah.
And she, you know, and she gets mad at first, and then she kind of just says, you know, because, yeah, let's just pack it all up and not do it because, you know, we're that stupid kind of thing. And it was just really good and says a lot. And I think it should be said right now to Congress and everybody about the space program as it exists right now.
Right. You know. And I love when she, that he goes, you have your money. And she says, thank you. And then she looks up at the camera and goes, thank you.
Yeah.
Because she is very well aware that somebody is watching her.
Yeah. I think I agree with you. I think Skerritt and John Hurt's character of Haddon or Haddon are probably the two best performances.
How ironic is that?
Yeah. And they were both in what?
They were both in Alien, 1979.
There's a key
right there.
Yeah. But I loved him with the glasses. I thought that was cool. Mm-hmm. I did hate, and I've got it in big bold in my notes, the stupid butler, guard, whomever on the planet that says, he rarely lands for anybody. You're a very lucky person. Nobody would ever say that about their boss to a stranger. Nobody.
No, a bad screenplay writer would, though.
Yes. Yeah. Very, very true. Very true. Very well said.
Yeah. I thought all I could think about was, what was it we watched recently with the Air Fortress where the guy never came down?
Oh, Black Widow.
Yes, it was Black Widow. And I was like, oh, he's like that guy. He just flies around all the time.
Yeah. Yeah. And then by the end of it, he's on the Mir space station.
Yeah. He's like, the Russians were kind enough to allow me to do my experimental cancer treatment up here on the Mir space station. Yeah.
Yeah.
That was weird.
Which was great.
Yeah.
It was just great. I thought, well, scene wise, let's talk about scenes before you jump into casting. So, what did you think about the opening?
Okay. I got to think back. With her as a child?
No, even before that, the very opening, it starts out so loud with all the
With all the different broadcasts and the different songs and the different snippets of famous speeches. I was okay with that. I really loved the whole going backwards.
Yep.
So you get exactly what he's saying, that all the noise we make on this planet is being heard, you know, 20-something light years away. Yeah, I love that.
I thought it was great. I thought that was a brilliant opening. And then to take that and put it into her eye as a child, you know, was a great transition. I'm hooked. And then going from that scene, the next transition was her sitting there at Arecibo. And for me personally, because, you know, in the late 90s, early 2000s, I let my computer be used by SETI. They had access to my processor because you could volunteer your processors all over the world to just help them compute and listen. And SETI's always been a part of, you know, I've felt strongly about it until it folded. And then the whole Arecibo thing was very sad to me. It's kind of like we talked about, what was it? Oh, Sisters. We talked about in Sisters how, you know, when you see the skyline of New York in the past and you see the towers. And you immediately go, it's like when I see anything from Arecibo, because, you know, Arecibo collapsed like 2 years ago.
I don't even think it's been that long, has it?
I thought it was in 20 or 21. Okay. Somewhere.
I just remember seeing it in the news recently.
Yeah, and it totally, and so it was very sad to actually see it and see it there and everything else because it was such a cool icon of science. And that was great to show Ellie too. And I feel, Jodie, I love Jodie Foster in everything. And she's great in this. I just think that at the end, she's playing sad Jodie and not, she should be defiant to them and saying, science led us this far and science will lead us farther if you'll let it. If your politicians will stop being politicians and start being humans, you know, kind of thing. If she had done something like that, rather than this whole cop out of, well, yeah, I guess there's no proof. So, you know, I don't have anything to say kind of thing.
Yeah. I got the feeling, you know, much like this movie reminding me of Forrest Gump, having come so close to its release date, her performance reminded me a lot of Clarice in Silence of the Lambs, where she is uncertain and she kind of submits you know, because, you know, there are higher male presences around her. And I didn't like that either.
No. No. And the
I mean, if it's a male that could potentially eat your liver, yeah, sure. But not some asshole that's just, you know, trying to steal your job.
And the the further misogyny of him always one-upping her all the time. Mm-hmm. And, you know, well, and every single guy except her dad in this movie screws her.
Yeah.
Every single guy except for the except for the blind guy.
Well, she screws Matthew McConaughey, literally and figuratively.
Well, but then he screws her, too, about do you believe in God?
He does screw her back. But, I mean, you know, she basically does not call him and he, you know, leaves his number. She purposely does not call him.
Yeah.
So,
well, and they make such a deal of the freaking compass. I'm going, okay, I understand.
Oh, yeah, that was stupid.
I understand a plant in a screenplay. You be planted here, and then later on it's going to pay off. Okay, and it paid off by literally what he said, someday this is going to save your life. Okay, yeah, all right. But that was so on the nose. I was going, really?
Yeah.
You let that get in the screenplay?
Sort of and it, and I guess, yeah, I told Dennis was watching it in and out with me. And he saw that scene where the chair vibrates and smashes into the ceiling. And I was like, oh, that's why they didn't want you to build a chair because everything's going to be fine without it. And she gets up to catch the floating compass. And that's when the chair does its thing. So really, it is. I didn't even think about it until you just said it. But he does say this will save your life. And literally, it does save her life. So it's kind of cheesy in retrospect.
Yeah, yeah, it was a plant that to me just paid off too much on the nose and didn't work.
Mm-hmm.
There was you know, I love Zemeckis. I love Forrest Gump. I love Back to the Future. I love what's the Goldie Hawn one that is so good with the hole in her stomach. The after
death becomes her.
Death becomes her.
Yeah,
love that. Bruce Willis.
Yeah.
Meryl Streep. I think he's so good at combining technology but making it almost seamless. In this one, it doesn't really work for me, all the Clinton stuff. And it's kind of like, oh, this is, you know, a scene that was cut from Forrest Gump.
Well, that's what I was going to say. There's a lot of that camera trickery and video trickery like that we saw in Forrest Gump, where it looks like he's in the room with, you know, Eisenhower, whoever it was.
Yeah.
And there's a scene where President Clinton gives a speech. And as soon as he walks off the platform, Angela Bassett crosses up to the platform,
yeah,
like a press secretary or whatever it is she is. And
yep, she's press secretary.
What's that?
She's press secretary.
Is she? Yes. Okay, because she seemed to have a higher position to me. She seemed to be calling a lot of shots. And I was like, what is she doing? That wasn't very clear. Anyway, she did get up there and start talking. And it did look like she was literally stepping onto the platform as he was stepping off because they had some lookalike, the back of his head or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Very, very Forrest Gump. So it was like, hey, Bob, we know you can do this. You've done it before.
Yeah. Just do your old tropes and get Silvestri to do some really nice romantic music underneath it. It'll be great.
Yeah. There was another director slated for this initially. Do you know who it is? And I'm curious as to what you would think.
Who?
George Miller was slated originally to direct this.
That seems extraordinarily odd.
I know, man. It'd be like Jody with a mohawk, and they'd be like fighting on motorcycles in outer space.
Tom Skerritt with no shirt and just chains.
No, Tom Skerritt shows up at the Arecibo, and she comes riding up on this three-wheeled motorcycle on a Mohawk.
Yeah.
You're not taking my project away.
That means that Gary Busey would be humongous. Or something,
yes. Right? And yes. He would have like a metallic mask, hockey mask, like Jason strapped to his head.
Yeah, I don't see Miller. You know, what Zemeckis did bring to this was all of, he's very good at emotion. He's great in emotion, even when he's doing action pieces like Back to the Future or something else.
And that's the Spielberg-esque thing I was commenting on earlier. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that all worked. And I think his casting worked. I just don't think his screenplay worked at all. And I think it had huge issues. And I had the question, it's right here in Big Bold. What do you think Carl Sagan would have thought about this movie?
Oh, I don't know, because I haven't read the book. If it's that drastically different from the book, he would not have liked it, I wouldn't think.
Well, I think he would have been upset with a lot of different elements of it. Like they misquote Occam's razor. Occam's razor doesn't mean the fastest is the easiest. That's not what the whole concept of Occam's razor means. But it's very a Hollywood interpretation of it. You know, the shortest distance between two points is a straight line. That's not Occam's razor. You know, the easiest, the simplest answer is usually the best one. That's not Occam's razor.
Okay.
That's not what it means.
Yeah, I didn't know what it meant. I just took it for granted that they were saying the truth.
Yeah, and that's basically, you know, the simplest is the truth or whatever. You know, that's weird. All the stuff where they're going, all the scientific jargon about we're within perimeters and, you know, I think we're within limits for launch. How do they freaking know? It's alien technology. How would they know when they're 75%
ready to go? It was in
that
three-dimensional cube instruction sheet.
The instruction manual said all the parameters to do
it. Should align when you get to this point. It's like IKEA. It's just got a little happy face, that says you've done it right.
We're in theory saying we're going to send someone across the galaxy to Vega, which is, hundreds of light years away. She even says, I think, is it 50 years?
Oh, like, I think it was 20-something. 26 or something.
I can't remember. But basically, they're talking about faster than light travel and using
Vega
Einstein.
Is actually a star. It's like a system of Vega, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And they're talking about the, Einstein's physics of, she will only age a couple of months, but on Earth, years will pass.
And that didn't happen.
And that didn't happen.
Because of the wormhole? I'm assuming that's what my take was on it.
Yeah. Correct, because of which that science works for me.
Okay.
But we are saying we're going to send her into space or wherever this technology came from without a space helmet. We're just going to put her in a cube and in a ball and send her.
That's what the IKEA instructions said. I told you, smiley face. Don't build a chair, whatever you do, or you're going to get smashed into the ceiling.
Right. Good thing she wasn't magnetically attached to it, as they said, was in parameters. Mm-hmm.
No, she's just going to float around. She'll be fine. Actually, she didn't float. The necklace floated. I was like, why isn't she floating?
Well, she was floating.
Was she? Okay. Yeah. They just didn't show her legs that much.
They just didn't do it well. It was. It wasn't as good as like Gravity.
No. Sort of. No, nothing about this movie is as good as Gravity. Nothing.
Or Arrival, by the way.
Right.
Another one that has a female protagonist that is really good.
I actually have that as a key. Any of the Alien Contact movies really could be a key to this.
Of course.
Yeah.
Of course. I'm just checking just a little bit of notes before. Are you going to do cast?
I can do some casting. I've got a little bit. One of the things we mentioned is that speech that Clinton gives. You probably already know this. I don't know if the people out in listening land do, but they were originally going to cast somebody as the president because they had a speech similar that would convey what they needed to about, we've talked to things in outer space. And then Clinton gave this speech about the Mars rock that worked so well, it just kind of floored Robert Zemeckis. He was like, oh, my God, I've got my clip. I don't need to cast a president now. I'll just use the clip from Clinton. But originally, Sidney Poitier was going to be cast as the president. So we would have had a black male president, which would have been very interesting for the time. But that did not happen because of Mr. Clinton. Anyway, Jenna Malone, who I know that name, but I can't really recall who she is, played Ellie as a child, excuse me.
Yeah.
But I know she I looked her up. She's still an actress. I'm just not as familiar with her repertoire. Our friend David Morris is in this movie again. Love him. Love him in almost everything he is ever in, which the last time we saw him, he was Jake Busey in 12 Monkeys.
Yes.
He was walking around with long hair and being kind of psycho.
The terrorist, yes.
Right, but he was understated and much better at it than Jake Busey is.
Yep.
So, Jodie Foster apparently was interested in this movie as early as 1995, but she dropped out. And her interest was re-sparked when there was a new revision of the script. So I'm curious about that. Gillian Anderson and Uma Thurman were both considered for the role. I would have loved to see Gillian Anderson in a big budget movie like this.
Yes, that would have been great. Mm-hmm. Yes.
And she can play bossy and submissive really well too. Yep. Probably better than Jody, I hate to say it. Anderson apparently was in another UFO movie though in 2018. I looked it up. It's called UFO and it was a British thing and I never heard of it. Have you?
No.
It's kind of ironic considering she dealt with UFOs for over a decade on the X-Files. And then one person auditioned for this role, and you're going to – don't be drinking anything when I say this because you'll spray it when I tell you who it was. Jenny McCarthy Wahlberg auditioned for this role.
Okay.
Yeah. No. Don't see that happening.
No. Nope.
Matthew McConaughey's role of Palmer Josh – that was originally offered to, is it Ralph or Rafe Fiennes? Rafe?
Rafe.
It's Rafe. And it, for some reason, IMDb spelled it Ralph. I thought it was spelled differently, though. So he was considered originally. That would have been way back when he was just kind of coming onto the scene. I think his brother did Shakespeare in Love around then. McConaughey dropped out of his role for the lead in The Jackal to do this movie. And The Jackal, I don't remember being that big a movie, do you?
No.
I actually saw it somewhere else. Oh, Sidney Poitier ended up doing The Jackal because he didn't end up doing this movie. So there's a little bit of a reciprocity there. McConaughey was suggested for this movie because of his performance in A Time to Kill, the John Grisham movie that made him a star. And after his screen test, everyone said they didn't consider anybody else. So they really, really liked him. And like I said, he has a certain chemistry that works. He's got like that star quality, I guess you'd say.
Oh, yeah.
To me, it's bigger than Tom Cruise. So there's an argument right there.
Yeah.
We mentioned Tom Skerritt, and we mentioned John Hurt. Love them. They're both from the 1979 classic Alien. I don't have any other casting on Skerritt. However, John Hurt was I had the note, too, about what you said to imagine what would happen if Bill Gates had lost his mind, and this is him.
Yeah. Yeah.
I pasted a lot of people in here because I didn't realize there's all these crazy cameos like in Forrest Gump. So I have like Larry King, Geraldo Rivera, Jay Leno, Geraldine Ferraro. James Woods is in this movie.
Yeah.
Crazy James.
Crazy. Now.
He is very crazy. However, according to producer Steve Starkey, he was the only actor they ever considered for that role. That says a lot. Because he's an asshole.
Yeah. Yeah, he's a jerk from the very beginning of it. But I think I got more emotionally invested in Skerritt's jerkiness than in Woods.
I agree. You know? Because James played it straight on, whereas mm-hmm. Skerritt underplayed it and made it more malice.
More manipulative. I mean, he was, you look at Kitts, I think was the name that Woods' character, he's essentially the
Michael Kitts.
The military guy. Mm-hmm. And from the very beginning, he will just try to dick you. That's the whole thing. Skerritt was much more evasive. You know, he would go, well, I'm trying to do this for you. Now I'm going to go. Mm-hmm. You know, sort of thing.
Yeah. He had Skerritt had several scenes where he could do that too. Like when shut down, Puerto Rico, Arecibo.
Yeah.
That too.
Which I do like that scene a lot. And that's a very good Zemeckis scene of the red Jeep driving up and him complaining about it took 3 airplanes and a Jeep ride through hell to get here and all that. In the background down the hill, we see her running up and she's running. She sees, she gets there. She goes, hi, sir. How are you? And he goes, oh, hey, still chasing little green men, and walks off. Yeah. And you just go, oh, my God.
And she actually says, asshole.
Yeah.
Yeah. So immediately she doesn't like him.
No.
No.
Really good. That was good.
And then the only we mentioned Jake Busey. I don't have any other cast members for him, but they should have had somebody. Not good.
Or just not overplay it. That was so heavy-handed.
Well, and, that may not have been his fault. That could have been Zemeckis' fault because the wig didn't help.
Nope.
And basically all he says is stare at the camera because, he's like watching her go by like a stalker.
Yeah, he never says a word to her or to anybody else. He has, when we first see him, he's doing his big pontificating about evil scientists are bad, kind of thing.
Oh, yeah. He's like giving his sermon or whatever. Yeah, I forgot about that.
Okay, this is a... What'd they say? A quarter of a trillion. Nobody even says that term, but a quarter of a trillion mm-hmm. dollars to build this. It's an international thing. And we obviously have the worst security on the planet because this guy can get there with a suicide bomb on his chest.
A lot of suicide bomb. I mean, he is completely wrapped in it. Yeah.
So it didn't, yeah.
No, it was not believable. And however, that leads me to my last little casting note. And that is, even though it's a weird scene and we wonder why he's there, Rob Lowe plays like the head of the Christian Coalition, which is inspired casting. I think it's great. They just didn't use it right. And wouldn't it have been much better had he been the terrorist? Because we wouldn't have expected it.
Yes.
What I'm saying?
It would have been great. And he could have actually strolled on acting like hey,
I got some official security
clearance.
Yeah.
I got security clearance because I'm friends with the president.
Right.
And all that stuff.
Yeah.
And then, boom,
Jake's out of a job and we have a somewhat better movie.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Would have been much, much more. That's a great idea.
Yeah.
Would have been much better.
Oh, well. C'est la vie. We don't work in Hollywood.
Well, everything's a little one note in this movie all the way through. Ellie's character, we talked about other movies that we don't like or we like or whatever. And the fact that what makes a really strong story or whatever else is this, change in characters, a character has something they have to overcome or change or move or do different. Ellie doesn't have a change in this. By the end of it, she doesn't change to religion. She doesn't suddenly become religious. Mm. She doesn't become political. But she also doesn't stick up for being a scientist, which was weird. And, if that was the change, it didn't work. But everybody else is kind of one note all the way through. Skerritt never changes. Had never changes. James Woods definitely never changes. McConaughey never changes. Everybody just kind of hits their beats and does their thing. And it seems really bad screenplay 101 to me, mm-hmm. kind of thing. Does that make sense?
Yeah, It does. There is no aha moment really with Jody. They try to make the aha moment with her visit to the Vegas system, and basically all we get is her, you know, getting to reach her dad finally because she was trying to reach him on the radio, I guess. I don't know. It's not that much, though. It doesn't satisfy.
Oh, no. The whole alien stuff doesn't work for me at all. I mean, I've even got in, you know, in my notes, what is the point of sending the message? Is it a test?
I think Sadie's trying to contact you.
Yeah, I don't know why.
We're getting a chime.
Yeah, I mean, is it a test to see how smart we can be and do stuff or what? It doesn't make sense to me.
I have some awards.
Sure.
The only thing this was nominated for as far as Academy Awards was sound, which makes a lot of sense because of that opening scene we talked about and because of just, I guess, the pulse sound that they go with. I don't know.
Yeah, which is actually from Doctor Who, by the way.
Oh, I think I had that in my keys. Cool. Yeah.
But, and sound design, especially for the launch, that whole sequence works. It's great. You know, the way as soon as they enclose her, suddenly everything gets so silent. Mm-hmm. And you just keep hearing her say, I'm ready to go. Okay, I'm ready to go. Okay, I'm ready to go. You know, over and over. Yeah.
Yeah, when she was breaking up, I was like, you need to keep repeating that because they're not hearing it. And then she started doing it. I was like, good, she listened to me. Yeah.
Jody always does what you tell her.
Yeah, she does. She's very good like that. Actually, she failed to receive a much-anticipated Oscar nomination for the performance in this movie, and some have speculated that it was because she was pregnant and refused to name the father.
This was before the Golden Globes.
Well,
right?
What do you mean, before the Golden
Globes? Isn't that where she came out?
Oh,
wasn't it the Golden Globes?
You know what? Maybe she did come out there. It was definitely before she came out, though. That had a lot to do with it. And they, it said the stigma could very well explain why she was snubbed. She eventually came out of the closet during her acceptance at the 2013 Golden Globe Awards.
Yeah,
her acceptance ceremony, the Cecil B. DeMille Award.
I remember that. That was a big deal. I mean, that was really good for her. It was brave, and it was.
What else? Golden Globes. She was nominated for a Golden Globe. Ironically enough.
Ironically.
Yeah. And then one thing I thought was interesting is that the Hugo Awards gave it a win for Best Dramatic Presentation. And that includes the director and writers. And then lastly, our friends over at the Academy of Science Fiction, Fantasy, and Horror Films gave her a Saturn Award. For Best Actress, and Jenna Malone a Saturn Award for Best Young Actress. And then it was nominated for Best Film and Director, but did not win. So it didn't win a lot of awards, and she may have got snubbed. She may not have. I mean, I don't know who else was nominated that year, but I don't know that this performance was that, you know, fantastic. It's not Silence of the Lambs, for sure.
Oh, no.
And then other than that, before we move on to keys, the only trivia I had was that, did you know that Peter Jackson did some of the visual effects for this movie?
Yeah. I think he did some of the transitional stuff, like with Dad there, the CGI stuff.
Okay.
And some of the opening, that opening pullback and everything else.
Interesting. It said that he was returning a favor to Zemeckis for producing The Frighteners, that Michael J. Fox movie.
Zemeckis helped produce that.
Yeah,
so
I have not seen that movie since it came out, and I added it to our list because I don't remember if I like it or not.
I can't remember either, but I remember watching it when it first came out. Yeah. But I can't remember if it was a good one.
It's like a comedy ghost thing, maybe. Yeah. I don't know. Anyway. Yeah. All right, so if we don't have anything else, you want to move on to keys?
Yeah, I mean, the only thing I've
every
got left
science
in my
fiction
notes
movie ever made. No.
The only thing I've got left in my notes that I didn't say was... you know, of course, the line that's so famous from this of, if it's just us and it seems like an awful waste of space, you know, and they repeat that like three different times during the whole thing.
Wasn't that a Saganism?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. That was in the novel. And he's, you know, he's kind of quoted as saying that
humans are a waste of space.
No.
Yeah.
That space is a waste unless there's something else.
Well, no. What I read was that if humans are the only life in the world or the universe, then they are a waste of space.
No, then it's a waste. It's just, no. No. It's a waste of space.
I like mine better. I think it makes sense because I think he's saying we are not the most evolved species.
Well, that's true too. I think that's kind of notable. Yeah. And just in my notes, I've got Deus Ex Billionaire.
Deus Ex Billionaire. So he could just pop in and save the day.
Oh, yeah. And not only just pop in, he sets up a baby satellite dish and
somebody goes in and puts that shit on her television so that, yeah.
Yeah, in her hotel room. So when she comes back, she can talk to him at the Mir space station.
Not just that, but he has access to a fax machine right next to it.
Yeah.
And sends her directions or whatever. Yeah, crazy shit.
Yeah. And
talk
and
about science fiction.
He worked with the Japanese and built his own secretly way over here that nobody noticed and all that. Yeah, like you said.
Yeah, I don't think so.
I've also got just a list of tropes that I made while I was watching this again for the third time. So, like, these are all the classic, you know, not necessarily good tropes of science fiction and everything else. The twist ending. So the 18 hours of static that we recorded, you know, the kind of little twist at the end. Time
runs differently. And I figured that out before they did it. I looked at Dennis and said, her film is going to be 18 hours long or her recording of whatever. And about that time, that's when what's her face? Angela Bassett said it to James Woods. And I was like, see?
Yeah. And yet no one at NASA, nobody in Congress, nobody knew about it.
Right.
Really. Anyway, the time runs differently. That's a big trope in science fiction. Of course, you know, as you know, for her, it was 18 hours. For them, it was 30 seconds or whatever.
Or a second.
The overly meaningful name. Her name is Arrowway, like the arrow that shows the way kind of thing.
Oh, cheesy.
This will help you on your quest. So we have to give the protagonist something that will help them. In this case, it's the compass that comes back later.
And you know, that little plastic compass is going to come up to pieces. It's not going to travel very well over the years.
No, it's a Cracker Jack.
It's a Cracker Jack prize. It's going to,
We've got the really hot scientist, and not only is she a really hot scientist, she's the only female candidate out of the 18 that they chose.
Actually, back in 1997, that might not have been that far-fetched, but.
Yeah, true. All the home movies are happy. We have a Hollywood heart attack to kill the protagonist's dad. I took a form you are comfortable with. I don't know if that's a Hollywood trope or if that's a Star Trek trope, but you know that I am in this form so that your weak mind can understand
so that you
me.
Won't scream and go insane. It actually could be a Lovecraft trope too, probably.
Could be, that's true. Yeah. but it inspired a key for me, which is Galaxy Quest, you know, when they have the things that change. Using
I knew you were going to do that. I was just waiting for it.
Using math as communication, you know, that's a very sci-fi trope, and it's very true, probably. I just don't know math.
I don't know it either. I feel like an idiot when they're talking about it, too.
Instead of Chekhov's gun, you know, we talked, I think, a few episodes ago about, you know, the whole theater thing of Chekhov's gun, which was the playwriting thing Chekhov used in short story and in plays, which is if you show a gun in act one, it has to go off before act three kind of thing.
Okay.
In this one, it is, it's Jake Busey. The Chekhov's gunman, you know.
Right. Yeah. Psycho Edgar Winner.
but those are just my choices. So what about keys? What keys do you have?
Well, I mentioned, any of those type of alien contact movies and, feel good Spielbergish type movies. So I meant to immediately go to E.T. and Close Encounters.
Mm-hmm.
but you mentioned Arrival. I had, that down as well.
Mm-hmm.
Everything else is just stuff I lifted from IMDb, if you want to go with one. One of them was that Doctor Who one that you said about the sounds of TARDIS.
Well, and I've got Close Encounters again, like you said, but mm-hmm. also because in Close Encounters, the signal was psychic. They could the message that the aliens were giving the humans was psychic. In this, it was an actual math, meaning construction plans, the IKEA plans.
Mm-hmm. IKEA.
I've got Interstellar, Gravity, Alien, and Arrival, all because, not just because of the alien contact, but because they all have strong females. Mm-hmm. All four of those movies have a female protagonist.
True. Very true.
Interstellar, because by the end of it, you're going, did it really happen? Did these people really dream this, imagine this, and there's no proof of what they did?
Okay.
And because it involves a wormhole.
Yeah, I was going to say, I've not seen Interstellar. However, I got it from IMDb that it talks about the whole space travel and how you would age and everybody would be dead when you get back. And apparently that same concept is in that movie as well.
Yep.
And exactly. It also has Matthew McConaughey. So
yep.
You've got that.
That's another key.
Well.
Yep.
Yeah.
She mentions at one point, when they're trying to decide what the signal is, she says it might be an Encyclopedia Galactica. That is actually a term from Isaac Asimov's Foundation, and Carl Sagan used it in the book, and so they used it in the movie. So I thought that was a direct key for him, kind of homage to another great science fiction writer,
mm-hmm.
sort of thing.
The book. It's not a movie, is it?
It is a miniseries now on... on Apple Plus, I think.
I'll reference the book since it's new. I've got that the four-ringed machine in the movie was originally designed for Terminator 2, Judgment Day.
Maybe. I've got that it's really similar to the drive propulsion system in Event Horizon.
I have that too.
It's the spin that ends up creating a wormhole.
Yeah, as soon as I saw it, I went, I've seen this before, but it was smaller, and it was like, was Larry Fishburne sitting in it maybe? I can't remember. No, he was in that chair that was floating around.
Yeah, that was it.
What else? I got that he had everybody watch 2001 for inspiration.
Maybe well, ironically, I
have any 2010.
I have 2010 because there's a lot in the beginning of 2010 with the same area of New Mexico that she is in, with all of the radio television telescopes.
I don't remember that movie. I saw it with you on video back in the 80s, and I still don't remember it.
It's great. It would have been much better than watching this.
Well, I think it's on our list.
Yeah. Okay, good.
What else? Apparently the long opening take that we were referring to with that was also used in Men in Black.
Well, the concept of it was because it pulls back and pulls back and pulls back, and then we see nebula, and then we see galaxies, and then we see all these this whole thing. And in Men in Black at the very end, they do all that kind of big in the cosmos, and then suddenly we realize we're looking at a marble, and an alien picks up the marble and flips it across.
You know, it's been a long time since I've seen that movie, and I did not remember that. So thanks for that recap.
Yeah, that's the closing credits, I think, of Men in Black, not the opening.
And apparently it was spoofed on The Simpsons. I've got that as well.
I'm sure.
Everything was spoofed on The Simpsons.
Isn't everything? Yeah.
Yeah, that's true. And then we mentioned Alien. Another thing that we haven't mentioned yet that even I knew without IMDb is this whole wormhole concept was a big mm-hmm. thing in Stargate.
Oh, gosh, yeah. That's what Stargate was, created a wormhole.
I never saw the series, but I did see the original movie. Isn't that Kurt Russell, I think? And then apparently it's also used in Deep Space Nine. I don't know, but.
Well, Deep Space Nine is in orbit around in stationary around a wormhole.
Mm-hmm.
To the gamma quadrant, I think.
I don't know. What it is. Yeah. I had forgotten I'd put this in there, but when she's saying, I'm okay, I'm okay, I'm okay, mm-hmm. apparently that's the same thing Scott Glenn does in The Right Stuff.
I forgot that. You're right. I'm okay to go. I'm okay to go. I'm okay to go. Yeah, he does say that.
Okay. That's true. And I had completely forgotten that I had cut and pasted that into my notes before I watched the movie. And then I watched it and I was like, keep telling them you're okay. Keep telling them you're okay. That's funny. The crazy character of Haddon could potentially be a reference to Captain Nemo.
Yep, I definitely could see that. Yeah, okay. Except he travels in space, in the air, rather than under the water.
And then
yeah.
Under the water, exactly.
No governments, no allegiances. Yeah.
And then
I could see that.
The only other thing I have is that they make a joke about photon torpedoes.
I've got a couple of other classic references. One, like I said, was the sound that she hears that is the message is the sound that the TARDIS makes from Doctor Who when it warms up, only mm-hmm. slower.
Right.
Kind of.
Well, thing. I thought that's what we were already talking about. I thought you already said that.
Yeah, well, I said it was. I'm just.
Oh, you're just reiterating.
It's in my keys.
Okay.
It's in my keys. But the two that I have that are classic is this to me was kind of like the nice version of the day the Earth stood still. You know, the day the Earth stood still is they make contact and the alien basically says, stop what you're doing.
Or we're going to obliterate
you. Or we're going to obliterate you. And this one goes, keep doing what you're doing and eventually you'll make it out here. This is small steps.
Oh my
this
God.
Is the first
this
step.
Is, you just gave me a key in your performance.
Okay.
You are George Carlin doing football and baseball. You are. It's like in football, we have to get to the end zone. But in baseball,
we're in a park.
We have to get to home base.
Yeah. Right. We're going home.
We're going home.
And my last one's another classic key, which is War of the Worlds. This, to me, the whole thing about this that they were trying to do, and that Sagan, from what I've read, like I said, I haven't read the book, but from what I've read about it, was trying to do in the novel was balance this whole politics, spirituality, and science. You know, and how do they mean? How does religion and science work together? I think. And how do they mingle? And like I've said, at the end of the book, they do mingle because the scientists have to realize that you have to have faith in the science, even when there is no proof, in order for it to advance. And that's kind of the complementary religion and science thing. But I think you get a much more emotional version of that in War of the Worlds because
you do.
Know, even the narration says, the smallest of God's creation helped protect the planet and that, you know, and all of that. And you get this whole, you know, it's in a church. The whole
I was going to say, they go into a church. Yeah.
Yeah. That's the sanctuary at the end of it. And, and so I think you get much more of an emotional feel of that rather than this Senate hearing where she goes, I give up, you know, kind of thing. So that's my take on.
Okay. Yeah.
And that's our take on contact. And we hope you'll love and watch this movie and enjoy it as much as we
Well, I mean, now that we've had this discussion, I realize there are definitely some flaws. I realize some of them subconsciously, I think. But I did enjoy it probably because I've never seen it before. And it is a Zemeckis movie, and it has some great people in it. So.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I would definitely not recommend. Not recommend it. I would recommend you watch this movie. And especially, like I said, you know, you research it online and you see all these stories of people who were inspired by it. And that's what led to their careers and yada, yada. And that's awesome. And anything that will help us embrace science and embrace getting off this planet, I'm all for, you know, unless the planet takes you to Fantastic Planet. Now, that is not a good movie that we would
either. Because then you could easily get crushed or eaten by some strange bug.
Right. Or the big blue guys would jump on you or whatever. Mm-hmm. Yes. But we hope that you enjoyed listening to us talk about it. If you are new, we would love for you to give us a review. Give us what you think. Hit the bell. Do all those fun stuff that help us to continue doing this. We also have a Patreon channel where you guys could join, and we do some special things just for our patrons there, including two original podcasts, one on The X-Files and one on Star Trek, the classic series. So we would love for you guys to join us there. And for as little as, you know, a cup of coffee, you know, you keep this website going.
Yeah.
Which is important.
Yes.
Sort of thing. So Tim, next week, are we still in sci-fi?
Actually, we are. I was going to bring that up for, I think because of our Stephen King thing back in December, we did some horrors in a row. So we're going to have a couple of sci-fis in a row. So next week we are back in outer space.
Boy, are we. It's going to be really trippy next week. So
yeah.
Join us for that one.
It'll be fun.
Tim, talk to you next time.
All right. Great seeing you. Bye.
Bye.